I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, WNYC.org. Various causes of the 2008 financial meltdown are well known by now, from subprime mortgages to exotic risky securities. Many of these causes stem from the same problem, a serious lack of oversight from regulators. How and why did things get so out of control? Well, journalist Michael Hirsch tells that grim story in his new book, Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. It's published by Wiley, and I'm happy it brings Michael to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Andy.
Now, I think I just have to get this straight right from the beginning, because I think I earlier referred to you as Newsweek's Michael Hirsch, and you were for many years, but now you've just switched jobs.
16 years at Newsweek. I'm now chief correspondent for National Journal in Washington.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. And, you know, I guess there's kind of a news peg to this book because you're talking about sort of this recurring cast of quote-unquote wise men who seem to occupy the White House and steer our economic policies. And I guess one of these guys just bolted, Summers, going back to Harvard where the women love him so much for all the nice things he's said about them over the years. That's kind of unfair, but I just had to take that shot at him. Larry Summers is leaving. I guess there's been a lot of attrition from the economic ranks. What's going on? Is this just typical midterm departure, leave taking, or is this something else going on?
No, I don't think there's anything typical about this Summers' departure or this crisis. Summers is one of the chief characters in my historical narrative, which goes back to the Reagan Revolution. I talk a lot about him in his earlier incarnation as one of the chief deregulators of the Clinton era. And so to a very striking extent, when Summers came in as chief economic advisor for Obama, he was cleaning up the mess that he had helped to create, although this all went unacknowledged, of course. And one of my arguments is that a lot of these guys who were vested in this financial system that they helped to create, including Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, it's very difficult for them to think outside of the box and do the kind of fundamental reform that they frankly need to do. Getting back to the broader theme, this crisis was not about a few Wall Street firms going crazy, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns and others, and a bunch of crazy products that we all heard about, collateralized debt obligations based on subprime mortgages. That was the proximate cause. But it had a long evolution going back three decades, and only then can you really, if you grasp that, I think, can you understand how deep and systemic this was in terms of the way the economy changed, the way Wall Street came to have the whip hand over the economy, the way some of our best minds and talents ultimately went from being physicists during the Cold War to quants on Wall Street during this latest period, inventing products that were so complex that not even the CEOs of these Wall Street firms understood what they were doing. This was a very, very widespread thing. One of the reasons that the entire financial system was on the brink of collapse a couple of years ago was because it took a long time for this to evolve into place. And that's the story that I try to tell in my book.
Well, you tell it very well. And I'd like to go back to sort of the primordial soup of all this. And it seems to me, you know, it comes down to this word regulation, which has become really demonized in our society. And you know, it's funny, as Americans, we kind of like laws. We always say there ought to be a law against that, and we ought to have a law about this and a law about that. And we a lot of the people who sort of are against regulations are always recommending constitutional amendments, which are the biggest laws of all. Mm. But regulations and the idea of regulation became demonized, at least in my memory, very much in the 70s, because when Jimmy Carter, Democrat, was elected, he was really big into deregulation. When did the nomenclature, the definition of regulation, become this terrible thing?
Well, sometime along this period, and you put your finger on it. I mean, that is exactly the story. The story is not so much about specifically what happened during, you know, what year. It's the zeitgeist. It was this period when free market fundamentalism, as Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, called it, came to be the sort of overarching way of thinking for everybody, to the point where governments were always bad, markets always good. It was the Reagan Revolution, which followed upon Jimmy Carter. You're right, Carter was among the first deregulators. Reagan really pushed that very hard. That was, you know, his big shtick. And there was a legitimate reason for it. I mean, big government was a problem during that period. My argument, and what I try to lay out in this book, is that it overreached dramatically. And what was lost, particularly from the 90s onwards, was the knowledge that had already been there about how different financial markets in particular are. Financial markets are always more prone to manias and panics. Wall Street supplies the lifeblood of a capitalist economy, capital, and you simply can't let them run amok in the way that they did. Because this whole period of sort of free market fervor existed, and it was sort of turbocharged after the end of the Cold War when, you know, you remember all these big statist economies were shown to be to have been ineffective in providing resources to their people. It got to the point where it became an act of heresy in Washington to advocate government oversight or regulation. Of course, Alan Greenspan's Fed was a big champion of that. And that's what we saw come to a horrific climax, if you will, during the financial crash of a couple years ago. And it took a long time before people realized how deep and systemic it was. And I think among the last, frankly, to realize it was President Obama himself. You know, I think he even pointed Geithner and Summers and, okay, they're going to fix the crisis. Well, it turned out that it was a lot more infected in the system than he or anyone else realized.
Well, it's funny. I mean, with these guys who are tapped for cabinet positions, it always reminds me a little bit of baseball managers. I mean, they're or football coaches. There's a limited cast of characters that it seems like we go back to time and time again, and they're probably some other people out there, or are there some other people out there who might have a slightly different perspective, but they're just not getting chosen?
Very much so. I mean, they're on the outside looking in. Brooksley Bourne, who warned against derivatives. Brooksley Bourne was the chairwoman of the Commodity Future Trading Commission, a sort of junior agency. But in 1998, she had a famous confrontation with Robert Rubin, then the Treasury Secretary, Summers and Greenspan. She wanted to bring in regulation for derivatives. She was very scared about this giant dark market out there, and they basically just squashed her. Joe Stiglitz, the New York-based Nobel-winning economist, had warned for years. He was also driven out of Washington. These are people who you would think might be welcomed into an administration in the aftermath of this crisis, but weren't. And, you know, I mean, getting back to Larry Summers, the news peg of the day, you know, his comments in the New York Times today I thought were very telling, were in some ways, his own best epitaph on his career in Washington. He talked about how they thought they had successfully contained this crisis, and it was contained.
He sounds like Tony Hayward.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Hayward, right, during the VP crisis or, you know, during the Cold War, we're going to contain
everything's under control.
But we're not going to change anything fundamentally. And that's really the bottom line here is Wall Street was not fundamentally changed. The same banking elites still dominate. The economy continues to be skewed toward Wall Street's whims and Wall Street's pay structures. And that's where I think, frankly, Obama, who some people thought was going to be the new Franklin Delano Roosevelt, really fell short. This was not a new deal after all. It was more of an old deal.
Well, you know, you bring up Roosevelt, and actually both Roosevelts, the Republican, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and FDR, were both seriously into regulation. I mean, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was, the original trust buster and antitrust, which I don't know what the current – my dad practiced some antitrust law. I keep on bringing up my dad today for some reason. It's not even his birthday. But, you know, antitrust law is kind of at a low a low ebb at the moment. But that was in the, you know, the early part of the 20th century. And then, of course, after the disastrous speculation on Wall Street that led to the Wall Street crash in 1929, there were regulations put in place and banking regulations put in place. Do we not learn from history? I mean, is there this problem of in the world of economics where people sort of think that they've outsmarted, as you said, there are now geniuses, right, you know, working in Wall Street, which didn't always used to be the case. It used to be kind of the, as Calvin Trillin said in a very funny op-ed piece a couple years ago, he said it used to be sort of the C students from Yale who would wind up working at the investment banks. And the problem is, now it's the A students, and there are all these math majors. It's just, did everybody sort of think, oh, great, you know, we can kind of forget about the past. This is a new paradigm, and we're just going to mint money, and everything's going to be fabulous.
I think so, you know, and you point up the Roosevelts. Absolutely. The two Roosevelts were responsible for some of the most fundamental changes. You know, FDR famously said during the Depression about the bankers, "I welcome their hatred." You know, I mean, he was demonized. And you don't really see Obama doing that. You see him kind of playing, you know, a middle path. And I think that's part of the problem. We haven't seemed to have learned from the past. During the campaign, Obama made a comment that startled a lot of Democrats when he praised Ronald Reagan as a transformational president. And he kind of dissed Bill Clinton. And you know,
Hillary was not too happy about that.
Right, none of the Clintons were. And I think the ultimate irony for Obama is that at a moment, at a historical moment when you really kind of wanted to end Reaganism, which had its healthy, I'm not demonizing Reagan or Reaganism. It was worthwhile at the time, but it overreached at a time when Obama's obligation was really to end this free market craziness and to find a proper balance between government and markets. And you know, that was the discussion we needed to have. He sidestepped it. You know, he actually became Bill Clinton again in his own characterization. And that's where I think, you know, we're falling short here. We don't see progressive voices, truly original thinkers, being welcomed into the administration. As one official who's in there now said to me, you know, when you look at the Obama economic team, their thinking runs the entire gamut from A to A minus. and that's part of the problem. Yeah.
I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lope today. I'm talking to Michael Hirsch. His new book is Capital Offense: How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. I'm at WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, of course, you mentioned the Reagan era, and I don't know if I would go as far as to say I thought it was a great thing, great idea at the time. At the time, I wasn't so crazy about it. But one thing that did happen in the 80s, which actually Mark Singer wrote about to great effect in his book Funny Money, was the SNL disaster, which was another case of an absence of regulation, where there was a small Penn Square bank, which was basically a shopping mall storefront bank, almost brought down our banking system because they kept on writing these loans and then selling them upstream to bigger banks, and was creating a tremendous house of cards. What were there regulations put in place in the aftermath of that?
Not enough, although clearly, ironically enough, that period really began this process of securitization. A lot of the bad assets on the SNL's and banks' books at the time needed to be sold off, and they developed securitization, which, of course, winds up, 15 years later, nearly 20 years later, becoming the subprime mortgage crisis, where you had all of these fraudulent and badly conceived mortgages actually imposed on people to feed the securitization machine that Wall Street had started and was selling around the world. Two big things happened. There were a lot of deregulatory moves. There was two things that I would point to. One, what Brooksley Bourne had warned about, this vast trillions of dollars worth of markets in over-the-counter derivatives, which went completely unwatched by any government. I mean, if the Reaganites wanted their laissez-faire experiment, they got it. They got a market where there was no supervision whatsoever. This was all going on for years, and warnings were ignored. Second, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which had separated commercial banks from investment banks and put in other restrictions, kind of went off with that, with a shrug. It was like, oh, okay, we're beyond this now. The big institutions can handle themselves. That was a sort of Greenspan view. And so what you had was effectively, without people realizing it until September of 2008, all of these traditional commercial banks that were backed by the government, federally guaranteed deposits, were getting into all these hairy trading practices and all of these risky products, and no one was watching because of the lack of regulation of derivatives. And that's what blew up, really globally in our faces some years later. And what no one realized with the repeal of Glass-Steagall is that they're really, particularly in an environment in which, again, as government was banned, markets were good, regulators were going to be way behind because they were the C students. No one was really watching the way all the firewalls had been destroyed in the financial system. And whereas in previous crises, you always had the sort of haven of safety, the big banks, would come in and rescue the day. We saw that during the long-term capital management crisis, for example, of 98, going all the way back to 1907 when J.P. Morgan stepped in and helped Wall Street. That was gone with the wind. And there were no longer any islands of safety. That's why we're in the hole now as taxpayers, basically for, you know, more than $1 trillion, because we simply allowed this to happen. And it happened in Washington. I want to emphasize, this is not a Wall Street story in my view. Wall Street always goes ape, if you will.
Right.
This is a story about the adults who are supposed to be watching on the playground.
Keepers.
Not what happened in the zoo.
Before we move on, there's so much to cover here, but I just out of curiosity want to know if you can explain a couple of things to me. What is a derivative? Can that be explained? Does anyone know?
Bet. Yes. A derivative is a bet.
It's a bet.
It's a bet on what a market is going to do, what a product like a mortgage is going to do in terms of returning a certain rate on investment. And derivative comes from it's derived from some underlying asset, whether it's a mortgage, whether it's a rent. Derivatives can be based on the movement in certain commodities prices, foods, wheat and corn. They became the great game on Wall Street during this period that we're describing. Investment banking, traditional investment banking, which was you go in, you come into some stodgy office and you've got a corporate client and he wants advice on how to, raise money by issuing new stock, okay? That was gone with the wind because a lot of these big corporations, particularly Fortune 500 companies, were issuing their own stock. They had their own investment bankers. So for the traditional firms like Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, that was no longer a big money-making business. Trading in these risky derivatives was. And so what you had was a Wall Street that went from somewhat responsible behavior with crises, but crises that were contained, to a Wall Street that was a giant casino. In fact, where the rules were worse than they are in Las Vegas, because at least in Las Vegas, when you go play craps or you go to the blackjack table, you know what the house rules are. No one even knew what the house odds were anymore in this game. And that's really what it was. It was a period when most Wall Street firms were making most of their money placing side bets on the underlying movement of interest rates, products like mortgages, whether countries would go up and down, things like that.
So, and CDOs and credit default swaps are more of the same. These are more.
Well, they were credit default swaps were a hedge against the feared downturn in some of the value of some of these markets. One of the reasons that went so sour was because AIG's financial products group, again unbeknownst to the people running AIG, was issuing billions of dollars worth of hedges to all these firms on the bet that the market wouldn't go that sour. Of course, when it went that sour, then AIG was up the creek and the taxpayers had to step in. But that's, that's really what happened with a lot of these fancy instruments. They got ever more fancy, ever more complex because they were unchecked by any regulators. And so collateralized debt obligations were these super complex securities based on underlying mortgage-backed securities, not mortgages themselves, but mortgage-backed securities. And then you had CDO squared and synthetic CDOs. What you had was these derivatives that were now several values removed from any underlying asset. And there was no longer any connection whatsoever between the borrower and the person who was doing the lending. I mean, they didn't know who they were. They could have been on other sides of the world and often were. And so there was just no connection, and it was – It got so out of hand that by the time it happened, the crisis happened, no one, no firm, no country really even had the resources any longer to bail out these firms. They had gotten so deeply into it. And that's really why we're in the period that we're in now, because this is something that evolved over at least a couple of decades when these products grew ever more complex. The quants, these ex-physicists from the Cold War, were getting farther and farther out in front of traditional bankers in terms of what they were doing. And, by the time we came to the crisis, there was absolutely no one on earth who understood what had just happened.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is Michael Hirsch. His book, Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street, is published by Wiley. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm having just a grand old time talking about how our world is crumbling. I'm talking with Michael Hirsch, who recently moved over to National Journal from Newsweek, so congratulations on his new gig. He is the author of Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Now, we already talked about Larry Summers,
right?
But I'd like to, as long as we're sort of going down this gallery of Batman villains, let's name a few names. Let's talk a little bit about Alan Greenspan, because in the 90s, Greenspan was such an iconic figure. And I remember that I think it was in Bill Clinton's first address to Congress, maybe it was his first State of the Union address, he actually seated Alan Greenspan next to Hillary, which was a tremendous sign of honor because he was clearly trying to curry favor with the Federal Reserve. And it was weird because, of course, we think of the Fed chairman as being kind of an independent guy. But, of course, he can be co-opted and courted like anybody else, right?
Well, you know, it was the crashing of Greenspan's reputation that inspired me to write this book, frankly, because I was there in the 90s. I was covering this for Newsweek when he was so lionized, and he was the maestro, as Bob Woodward called him in his book. You know, one of the committee hearings in Congress that he had to appear at, the chairman compared him to a Roman general at a triumph and said that they, the committee, were like the peasant, you know, whispering in his ear, remember, you're only mortal. And this was the kind of reputation he had because he was seen as a maestro who could move rates thither and whither, you know, depending on what he was sensing in the markets. And there was this boom period. But behind the scenes, and this is the fascinating part of the Greenspan story that I get heavily into, he was what I call the stealth ideologue. He was basically quashing every effort at regulation, which a belief that he came to many, many years before in a parlor not far from here in part of Manhattan. Where Ayn Rand, author...
He was one of the kids in her inner circle.
Part of what they jokingly referred to as the collective. And I have scenes of Greenspan described by other members of this group literally jumping up and down with joy as they read the pages of Atlas Shrugged as they were being written by Ayn Rand back then in the late 50s. And he grew very passionate about her. She was actually at his first swearing-in when he became chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Gerald Ford. And it was a kind of a lifelong a love affair for him of her philosophy. And so this is what was going on behind the scenes. It's never made headlines because this is all pretty arcane stuff, financial regulation. I mean, who was really paying attention to any of these committee hearings or any of these discussions, you know, in the Fed? But at every turn over a period of 18 years, he quashed efforts to start any kind of regulation of banking or any of these banking products. And, you know, we've already discussed the ultimate outcome. And, of course, for Greenspan, there was that shocking moment in October 2008, after everything had crashed, after we were really on the precipice of a depression, when he said, my entire intellectual edifice has collapsed. I mean, this is I really believe that these giant firms would never go so far as to allow themselves to be destroyed. He did not comprehend, you know, what he had helped create. And I thought that that was just a great human story because Greenspan is not one of these ranting ideologues of the kind, you know, that we hear so much now on, say, the cable TV talk shows. He's a gentleman. He made, you know, one of his good friends in Congress was Teddy Kennedy, you know, the uber liberal. I mean, he was a man who could reach across the aisle and he performed very well that way. But always in the back of his head, there was this Ayn Rand gene working away. And so all attempts at supervision were swept aside, and that had devastating consequences.
Well, so he was a true believer. I mean, he wasn't in any way cynical. This was just he thought he was doing the right thing.
He genuinely believed his heart was in the right place. He genuinely believed that markets are always going to know better than governments, no matter what the issue might be. At one point, he was even against antitrust law. He wrote a piece for Ayn Rand's journal at one point saying that that businessmen's own self-interest would prevent them from doing fraud. And that's another issue he later revisited. As he has more recently revisited the idea of giant size in these financial institutions, he's actually been out ahead, interestingly enough, of the Obama administration in calling for breaking apart the big banks. So you can see the intellectual journey he's had to make in the last couple of years, and he deserves a little bit of credit, frankly, for admitting error, which is not something one sees a great deal of in Washington.
I remember reading that Bob Woodward book about the first Clinton budget and his courting of Greenspan. I think James Carville said something like, if there's reincarnation, I want to come back as the bond market. Like, he thought
exactly.
The bond market was the most powerful thing. How did Clinton's obsession with that and with he was obsessed with inflation and keeping inflation low and appeasing the bond market. How did that play into problems that we saw later on?
Well, it was very much a part of it. And this is another the story of Clinton and his team is another fascinating journey, intellectual journey that I try to document in my book. Clinton was a populist. I mean, he wasn't a market man, but he recognized to get elected, he had to become a new Democrat. Remember, this was in the post-Reagan era when you really had to come out and say that big government was bad. And at the same time, when he hired people like Robert Rubin and others who had come from Wall Street, I mean, he was informed in no uncertain terms, look, we have got to appease the bond market. The deficit is huge. If the bond market traders are not in some way satisfied, they're going to continue to drive up rates. That's what Rubin told him in the early days of the administration. And so Clinton made the hard choice to give up some of what he had campaigned on in 92, which middle class tax cuts and so forth, and to focus on reducing the deficit. And by the mid-90s, the economic boom had begun, and there was a sense that appeasing the bond market worked. And I think that was really the start of the Clinton administration's move more and more toward Wall Street and a Wall Street point of view, to the point where, frankly, the relationship by the mid to late 90s between Greenspan, Rubin, and Larry Summers, who was Rubin's deputy and then his replacement as Treasury Secretary, was utterly simpatico. I mean, they agreed on almost nothing. It was quite remarkable to watch because there has always been a gulf, or had been, between the Federal Reserve's view of the world and the Treasury's view of the world. You know, generally, administrations, Treasury departments like to see rates low. The Fed likes to keep them high, take away the punch bowl. That was all gone with the wind here as well. And you had this – everyone was on board with this idea that, you know, you keep the markets going, you keep financial innovation going, you don't regulate capital, and we're all going to be made happy.
Well, now these guys, I mean, you know, Rubin is somebody who keeps popping up again. You know, he keeps on reemerging. And Wall Street's influence in Washington, is, as you detailed in the book, is bigger than ever. It's going strong. How do we unwind this? Because it seems to me one of the problems is as wealth gets more and more concentrated in Wall Street, Wall Street then winds up having more powerful lobbying power, you know, and control.
Yes.
And so what's the fix? If it seems like we're in a very vicious cycle here.
Well, there isn't any easy fix, because anything that takes this long to build up, in other words, this very powerful Wall Street, this Wall Street dominated economy, is going to take probably at least as long to unwind. But there are fixes, and there are progressive thinkers that could be brought in. I mean, among my more interesting characters to me in my book is Paul O'Neill, who you remember was George W. Bush's first Treasury Secretary. Everyone saw him as the sort of Mr. Magoo type, and he wasn't Robert Rubin. You know, he didn't talk smoothly. He didn't defer to Wall Street.
Well, and he was actually a hilarious gaffe machine as well. I
mean, he was a hilarious
gaffe
machine.
He was the one who said, you know, he went down to Latin America and he said, we're not just going to lend money to any banana republic dictator.
Yeah.
You know, every time he opened his mouth, he was saying something ridiculous.
Yeah, utterly unfiltered. But among the things that he said that he got in trouble for was to talk down to Wall Street, was to say, I'm not going to, you know, why should I consult all these bond traders? And of course, everyone went, you know, was outraged. Actually, if you look back, he did make some gaffes. But if you look back at a lot of the things he said and did at the time, he actually looks pretty enlightened. He looks like a guy who really represented traditional business interests from the real economy. You know, he was chairman of Alcoa versus Wall Street. And I interviewed him fairly recently, and he said to me, you know, this 2,000-page financial reform law that they put through, which is only going to change things marginally, you could have made it two pages. On the first page, you would basically require banks and financial institutions to stake 20% of their capital on every loan and investment. Okay, that would automatically make them vested in with a personal interest in whatever they were doing. And then you require potential homeowners to put down 20% equity if they're going to take out a mortgage. And he says, that would instantly restore sanity to the financial system. It would also help to rebalance the economy. And this gets into the fundamental structuring issue. We've got to find a way to get ourselves to a place where our best minds and talents aren't becoming financial engineers, but are starting to become real engineers again. I mean, that's what everyone is talking about beyond the recession, right? They're talking about how do we regenerate our economy so we're producing good stuff again. So we're, whether it's biotechnology or, you know, some new high-tech area, that we're a leader again. Obama has talked about this in terms of education, job retraining. You know, we're all aware that, for example, behind these terrible numbers, 9.6 unemployment, is a mismatch between the skills that are demanded, companies that are actually looking for people to fill their jobs, and what's out there in terms of those who have lost jobs and can't find new ones because they're not properly trained. So we need to figure out a way to do a lot of retraining, a lot more education, and to get some of these wonderful talents that are doing all this fancy math on Wall Street.
Back to building rockets, maybe.
Back to building rockets or whatever the case might be. Whatever today's Apollo program or today's infrastructural program is going to be, that's what we need to do, and it hasn't been done yet. Nothing has been done. Obama didn't use the bully pulpit during this whole period. Congress didn't use its legislative powers to somehow reorient compensation structures so that, you know, I mean, look, let's face it. I mean, what you can still get paid on Wall Street now on the taxpayer's back is just as much as you were getting paid back in 2006 and 2007. And there's a huge gap between what these firms pay out to their best talent and what the rest of the economy, you know, except if you're like a Hollywood star or a major, athlete. Right. You're going to make vastly more on Wall Street. And I think we have to figure out a way to reorient ourselves.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm talking to Michael Hirsch, the author of Capital Offense, How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Now, we just have a little time left, so I just want to walk through recent events. Sure. Actually, I just saw the new movie Wall Street 2.
Oh.
So I got to see Oliver Stone's reenactment of the financial meltdown. Have you seen it yet?
I have not.
Well, he's, you know, it's basically a reenactment. He's he's doing the whole Goldman Sachs, New York Fed, Lehman Brothers story.
There must be a conspiracy theory in there if it's Oliver Stone, right?
Well, except in this case, I don't think he needed. He didn't need to add ingredients. Yeah. It was all there. TARP and the bank bailout. That's been demonized. Tea Party is demonizing as the worst thing in the world. We learned different things about it at the time. I have a couple of questions. One is, was it necessary? Would all the ATMs have suddenly dried up and the financial system crumbled? And my other question is, the people who supported it, like the Bush administration, George Bush, and the people who voted for it in Congress, did any of them know what it exactly was when they were supporting it?
Not really. certainly Bush was absolutely blindsided by this. You know, in the fall of 2008, before the election, Bush was thinking about giving a series of legacy speeches about all the good things he had done, and one of the things he was proudest of was his robust economy, according to his speechwriter, Matt Latimer. And so he was completely stunned by what they had to do. But let's not, you know, put too fine a point on it. They had to do it.
And
I think that both the latter stages of the Bush administration under Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and, of course, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, and in the early stages of the Obama administration, they did bring the economy back from the abyss. I mean, there was a period just about 2 years ago, mid-September of 2008, when every major financial institution, including the best and the brightest, so-called, like Goldman Sachs, were in danger of failing.
Mm-hmm.
You were really in imminent danger of a Great Depression. Christina Romer, the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors, later said that the loss of wealth during that brief period, household wealth, was actually greater than it was during the worst weeks of 1929 and the Great Crash. You really had we were in grave danger. And so it's revisionist history to go back now and say, oh, this was just, you know, big government getting in the way. Big government had become absolutely necessary at that moment because the free market had failed so badly, quite frankly.
Right.
Now, there are other questions to be asked. The ones we're talking about whether a deeper restructuring should have followed the crisis. But I don't think there should be any doubt in anyone's mind that bailout, the TARP funds that basically sort of partially nationalized the banks for a period because the government took a stake in them, were necessary to keep the system from failing.
Well,
and
maybe,
that's not to say that 6 to 8 months later you don't then go into the banks after they're healed and say, okay, this is what you're going to do, which I think we fail to do.
Well, Michael, this has been a thoroughly depressing conversation. I want to express my appreciation for bringing me down. I'd like to go to another country or something, but they all have the same they have the same obligations that we have. I've been this is Andy Forowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lofate, and I've been talking to Michael Hirsch, written a great new book, Capital Offense: How Washington's Wise Men Turned America's Future Over to Wall Street. Michael, thanks so much for hanging out.
Thank you, Andy, for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Alan Kazai talks about his efforts to become what he calls a big citizen and how to achieve social change. Then Arab-American comedian Dean Obadalla on headlining the multi-city tour of Arab-American comedians, Arabs Gone Wild. And finally, Sam Wainwright Douglas discusses his documentary, Citizen Architect, about the late great architect, artist, and educator, Samuel Mockbee. Plus, our latest underreported segment. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from A.D. Brown, Josh Bell, Max Bass, Todd McGovern, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. We'll see you tomorrow.